Sure. We have some great people here, a lot of information. And bring them up. We have the general director of New York's wonderful anthology film archives, John Miri Peary. Yeah. The founder of the Nova Theater Circuit and the president director of film programming at the Avon Theater Film Center, Adam Birnbaum. Emily Russo, who is co-president of the excellent distribution company Zeitgeist Films. And the aforementioned Michael Tuckman from M. Tuckman Media, great film distributor. I'm Dylan Skolnick from the Cinema Arts Center. This has been a topic that we've been wrestling with for the past couple years. The Cinema Arts Center just is completing our digital transition. We're now running, as we speak, digitally, and I still love film, but I also feel like now I've sort of drunk the digital Kool-Aid and have become a big fan of that as well. It's working really well. It's a beautiful image, and it works really. It's a real pleasure to be using that now in addition. But this is a time of transition, and times of transition are really stressful and tense. So hopefully I'll have some good information here for people to get to learn more and share and relieve, hopefully, some of that stress. There's still, of course, the stress of paying for this equipment, but hopefully this will be information that will take some of the mystery and unknown out of it. So I'm going to ask a few questions of the panelists. Feel free to chime in. I know there's a lot of knowledge here in the audience as well, and we want to take advantage of that. So one thing that I think is very kind of a central thing, and I want to sort of turn specifically to Adam and Michael, who deal with a lot of very different kinds of venues, and the question of, you know, what venues have to do this right away, and what venues can wait?
I think if we're talking about theatrical venues, whether they're playing first run commercial film or art fair, be it on a first run basis or a sub run calendar house basis, I would say that unless you are okay with and committed to only playing art fair from those distributors who are willing to allow you to show films in the Blu-ray format, that you essentially now need to have a DCP-ready projector, and that there's really little wiggle room left in that landscape.
Michael, you have any?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much exactly correct. The one caveat, yes, as soon as you can is the best thing, but if you have, as Leslie was saying earlier, a very large screen, I mean, that's even more of a rush to do it. You know, there are a number of theaters that, you know, that I work with that do Blu-ray projection, and it works. I won't say it works. It works well enough if the screen size is the right size, and by the right size I mean smaller, because you can still get, you know, the projectors in the last 10 years have gotten a lot better, and you can get a good image on that, but you can't really try to force that out of more than, I would say, like a 100-seat theater at most, you know? Again, I'm not saying that, you know, you can stick with Blu-ray, but if you're having time, if you are playing strictly art, and it is taking a while to raise that money, you know, as long as you have a smaller screen, it's not advocating, but saying that it does exist there.
Just to dovetail from that, I mean, if you're in the process right now of trying to make a determination of where should we spend our money, how quickly, and on what, I think it would be foolish to spend less on a sort of temporary or on a solution that effectively won't give you access to all of the product that might be out there for you to use. You know, whatever it might cost, that incremental difference will ultimately be worth it because, number one, you'll have a better resolution quality in your picture by having the DCP unit, and by virtue of having that server through which you ingest the hard drive or get something by satellite feed, you open yourself up to the possibility of booking a film from any distributor, including those who are the most stringent about what formats you can receive a film in. So, you know, I would advocate that you go all out rather than part way, unless, to Michael's point, you have a very small screen, you have a very limited niche focus on a particular slate of film that does not include the studio product or the mini majors product. And if you don't care about having any of that and you have the small screen, only under those circumstances would it make sense.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the other one would be, you know, taking the grossing potential of your theater as a, in terms of how you buy a DCP system. Like, if you're not, if you don't have the biggest grossing potential, it's better to raise the money and just get, you know, buy the projector outright instead of going through an integrator. Dylan, you could probably answer this, if the integrators are even offering deals anymore, or have they shut the door?
I'm not sure about that, but I think there'll be folks on the second panel that'll be able to answer more of those. The second panel is going to be more technical and financial stuff.
Gotcha.
But so I think so we'll there still may be deals. I don't know.
Right.
The door is pretty much closed.
The door is pretty
mostly closed.
Okay. Yeah. People, just so people know, when it's saying integrators, that's talking about a whole system known as virtual print fees that involve subsidies for theaters to pay for their equipment, but also involved, I'm saying involved because it seems like maybe it's over, but involved or involves a lot of limitations on what you can do, a lot of control from the film distributors on your programming. So just so people know all the terms, that's why I'm jumping in. What are some companies that you think are gonna be, which of the companies are gonna go all DCP pretty soon?
Leaving the studios out of it, although I do think they're going to. Does anybody play studio product here, just to get a sense of what the audience is interested in knowing about? Okay. I mean, you know, the major studios have been threatening for a very long time to just completely switch formats, and I really do think it's imminent. I mean, I've heard from different distributors that close to 90% of screens in the country right now have been deployed with DCP. So that remaining 10% is a very small sliver. Many of them don't mean enough, unfortunately, I have to say it that way, to the distribution companies, that if ultimately they say we're drawing the line in the sand here at the end of August or October or whatever it is, you know, they're not going to blink an eye at that lost revenue. I mean, there are theaters that I book where they will not gross as much money on the film's run of engagement for what that 35 millimeter print will cost. So there are economic concerns that the studios take into consideration. So I think it's soon. I've had conversations with some of the mini majors like Focus Features and Fox Searchlight. It's soon. I mean, you know, there are a couple of Focus releases coming out at the end of the summer, Closed Circuit and The World's End, which, you know, they may or may not strike 35 millimeter prints for those films. So it's upon us. I mean, it's not something that we can really work around or ignore for much longer. And even if there are companies striking 35 millimeter prints, again, they're at a premium. You know, unless you have a venue that's a real gun that can gross, where you can justify the cost of the print to the distributor so that they strike one, or where a studio like a Disney, for instance, is so insistent upon getting every single date that they can in the country for a Monsters University that they don't care that the print will cost more than they will ever get back in dollars from your theater, then the window is really rapidly closing, is what I would say.
Yeah. So I want to turn to our distributors here, Dennis and Emily, about what formats you're currently using and what you, how you think that's going to change in the future.
Okay. Hi. Well, I just, you know, it's funny how nostalgic you could start to feel. When I started out in this business, we were distributing our films in 16 millimeter to theaters, actually, which is just amazing to think about. And then slowly over time, theaters stopped really showing 16 millimeter, and then everything was really in 35 millimeter. And then, you know, we had the challenges of the blowing up films to 35 to be able to give them a release, which was a financial burden on either us or the filmmaker or both. And then the manufacture of all these 35 millimeter prints, when, you know, we would have a successful film, we would have dozens of prints, if not, you know, even almost 100 prints of one of our releases. And then after the release is over, then you had all these prints to store, and you had all this money to spend on that, and the prints would break, and they'd get scratched, and we would order them from Europe, and they would be a fortune, and the euro was bad against the dollar. I mean, you know, all of this stuff was dogging us all these years. But I loved film, and I mean, that 35, the way it looked and the way it sounded and the whole thing. So when the digital conversion began, you know, and I saw the writing on the wall, it was a mixed feeling about it, because I do kind of miss the whole 35 thing. But on the other hand, it's a cost savings for distributors, for sure, even with the VPF fees, which we do have to sometimes pay in certain markets. The DCP itself is less expensive than a 35 millimeter blow up, and you can have as many DCPs as you need or want to make. They're very inexpensive. They're not, and when they're done, it's just a hard drive. I mean, they just recycle it and put something else on it, and you don't have all this storage fee and all these prints sitting around that aren't doing anything anymore. So I kind of come around to it. I'm into it now. This is like now, and it does look good. It looks beautiful. Our films look beautiful. The DCPs look amazing. They are, and except for the key problem that Leslie described and the few little snafu things that can happen, you don't have the kind of problems that you had with 35 millimeter with degradation and, you know, repair and maintenance and all of that kind of stuff. So it's a little bit of a win-win, really, in all of that. But now we're grappling a little bit with what to do with our inventory of 35 millimeter prints, you know, because hardly anyone can play them anymore. I mean, I think we'll still keep on hand a few of the titles that are still in our catalog, that are still active, but we're not ordering any new. Nothing's being ordered in 35. In fact, there's hardly any labs that are making 35 millimeter prints anymore. They've closed down those facilities, so we got stuck a little bit right around that conversion time where I think MoMA wanted to buy a few 35 millimeter prints, and we couldn't actually make them anymore because the labs that had the negatives didn't make 35s, and to take the negatives to another lab would have required, you know, new timing issues and blah, blah, blah. So there were a few lost opportunities to even sell some of a new 35 millimeter print because of the labs not being in that business anymore.
And how do you feel about the Blu-ray thing?
How do I feel about the Blu-ray thing? So I think we're getting away with a lot of Blu-ray because our films play in a wide variety of theaters. We play in, you know, the bigger art theaters, but we also play in a lot of small venues, and we do make our films available on Blu-ray, and we do play them on Blu-ray. In fact, I think Hannah Arendt is playing on Blu-ray at the Quad right now. I think it is. Although they do have DCP, but for some reason I seem to feel like they're playing it in Blu-ray, but maybe I'm wrong. So we ship Blu-rays to these small venues that are still showing, that don't have DCP yet, that haven't done DCP conversion, and we're happy to play there. And we don't get complaints. Nobody says it doesn't look good, the quality's not good. It's fine, for now, anyway. John, did you want to?
Yeah, are you transferring films in your back catalog to? Are you transferring films to digital formats?
So no, not yet. I mean, that's a little bit of a funding thing and figuring out how we're going to pay for that. Some of our European titles are being digitized in Europe at the cost of the French government, which is and the German government. They seem to have a little deeper pockets for these kind of projects. So we can benefit from that, and we can take DCPs when they're manufactured, when they're created elsewhere on some of our titles. But for us to go and take one of our titles and make a DCP, we have not done that yet. I'm not saying we won't, but it will be a business decision. It will have to justify. It'll have to be a film that, you know, we feel will play enough markets as a repertory title to warrant it, unless there's some grant thing out there. But since we're not a nonprofit, we probably can't get that anyway.
Are there any titles you have that are only 35 at the moment, that if you don't have 35, they're unplayable?
Yeah, tons. I mean, basically our whole back catalog, everything that we haven't released since the last 2 years is basically in 35 millimeter. Nowhere in Africa, Amy and Jaguar, I mean, you know, Poison, I mean, you know, all of these films, they're all in 35. We don't have DCP.
Wow. John, I didn't forget you over here. The anthology currently doesn't have digital. How is that affecting your programming?
Well,
has it had an effect yet?
I think it's beginning to. I think that we are able to get away with not having DCP a little bit longer than some venues might, because we do work with the studios a lot, but we're not showing first-run films with the studios hardly at all. Most of the first-run films that we're screening, we're working directly with smaller distributors or the filmmakers or sales agents from abroad. But there are some studios that aren't making their archival prints available anymore. And even though they exist, and even though we may have screened some of the very same titles in the past, they're only making them available in some digital format. And in recent cases, we've had to complete some series by showing films on DVD or Blu-ray as a result, even though, you know, there's a print in a vault somewhere. But we're also aware that we do have to convert to DCP soon, and we're going to add it to our available formats. We're not going to lose 16 or 35 in either of our two theaters.
This just now open it up to everybody. I mean, what do people feel? Do people have any sense of the positive and negative effects this has on programming in general?
On programming.
Programming, yeah.
Be more for.
Well, I think starting with the negative to accentuate some of what was just brought up here by my cohorts, there's just a vacuum right now. There's this, in between, if you will, where certain movies are available in the DCP format, then others aren't. They're only 35. Then something else may only be 35 and Blu-ray. And then to take it a step further, and something we haven't gotten into totally yet, but that constantly is a peeve of mine as I try to help program certain clients of mine who play repertory titles, is that the studios themselves have imposed restrictions on what formats they'll actually allow you to play. So for instance, 20th Century Fox will no longer allow the exhibition of a film in the Blu-ray or DVD format. But they might not have a 35 millimeter print available, and by chance it just so happens that they have not yet struck a DCP of the movie. So how do you play that film? That's something that is a head scratcher.
Can you play that film? I guess it's possible.
If you have deep resources, you may be able to find a private collector out there occasionally who has a 35 millimeter print, who's willing to either loan or, you know, rent it to you for a fee. You have to pay them whatever it is that they charge. You still have to pay the licensing fee to the studio, and you can circumvent the rules that way. But there's this odd stringency on the part of Fox and Disney being the other one, where they will no longer allow the exhibition of films in the DVD or Blu-ray format, yet don't have a print perhaps or a DCP, where it's just in a void. So that's a real complex issue that the studios have created themselves that we don't necessarily have a way to navigate around. The only thing that I would say is, if as you are changing over to digital, you have the ability and the physical space, logistically speaking, to keep your 35 millimeter projection system and any other decks that you might already own, that in the interim period, it's very sensible to do that, because this is a very haphazard process. And when you read these articles about the industry changing over to DCP, so much of it is just addressing the needs and interests of, you know, the major studios and the major chain exhibitors and big commercial films, and it's forgetting about the discussion that we need to probably have here about our own needs. And so I would say that that's the most critical piece to flexibility. As far as the major pros, I mean, if you're in a secondary or tertiary market where you had to perhaps wait a very long time in the past for a 35 millimeter print to be circuited around because company XYZ has only struck 10 or 20 for the country, I'm finding that for those theaters that I book, whether they're on calendar dates or open-ended runs of engagement, by virtue of it being very easy to strike another hard drive or send another Blu-ray out, you can actually get the film much sooner. And in addition to that, particularly for those companies who are okay with the Blu-ray format for exhibition, I'm also finding that the rules are changing and bending a little bit, where because it's not a 35 millimeter print, because there isn't that shipping cost, the wear and tear on the print, that they may be more flexible with you about how you can run the film. So perhaps in the past you had to run the film for a number of weeks or at least a week. You may now be able to just book it on Blu-ray or hard drive for a day or 2 days. So there is some greater programming flexibility, I think, within the rules and what you can or can't do and how quickly you can gain access if you're in a smaller market.
That's definitely affected distribution that way. I mean, you know, there were markets like Albuquerque or Santa Fe, which would have been 2-3 months down the line with 35 millimeter prints, and we can do those, you know, second or third week. If it makes sense for the film, but your rollout strategy now is more dictated by what makes the most sense for the movie as opposed to what makes the most sense for the cost of prints that's going to be out there and the cost of shipping those prints. I mean, a Blu-ray, I spend $5.95 shipping priority mail, and it's guaranteed 2-3 days. They have tracking now for no extra charge. It's really incredible. And the same, and what, you know, Adam was saying, there was a film I was working on a few months ago where Adam was trying to get it into his theater in Baltimore. He had a festival starting on a Friday. So he had a 4-day, you know, Monday through Thursday. I can get your press coverage. Can we get a Blu-ray copy of the film? Sure. There's no way I could have, you know, paid for a print to get over there or even covered the shipping of an existing print for a 4-day engagement. It just gives you so much more flexibility.
Questions out there?
I have a question.
Oh, hold on. They're going to pass you the microphone so the people on the radio can hear you.
I have a question about longevity of the DCP, the digital medium. For example, in Hollywood, there's a film called A Fool There Was from 1915. With Theda Bara, that's film history. If you are able to see it because it was made on a film and it's still around. With digital material, which is like the open key that disappeared, right? You can't project it. How long will this digital material be around? Will you have a history of it? Like in 10 years, 15 years, 50 years?
We're all looking at Dennis now.
Yeah, I'll guess I'd take that one.
Take a wild guess. But yeah, I'm interested in film.
Well, first
history.
Of all, there is the Museum of Modern Art here present, who I believe has the 35 best material on A Fool There Was, and they're going to be around forever, and their film vaults are built forever.
But
and
I mean so the digital.
Now right. I'll get to that part. There is a lot of. I am not only the co-founder of Milestone Film and Video with my wife, Amy Heller, in the back row, but also I'm on the board of directors of the Association of Moving Image Archivists, where there's quite a few members here in the association here too. And there are two things that most archives and archivists are, their mandate. One is to preserve and one is access. And there is, especially with all the new students graduating from the schools, Katie was one of them, there's a ton of them, who are exceptionally talented, access is a very important part of preservation, that films don't exist to the world without giving access to them. We'll talk about that later, Katie. And so there is a real hope for the future that this gives you digital tools to allow access that you can't. Some of my prints, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed was $7,000 for the print and $7,000 for the tinting and toning. And this is a 65 millimeter print. Archives can't really afford $15,000 for one print when they have millions of them. I was surprised 2 years ago, I went to the Berlin Film Festival. They have an amazing archival side of the festival, as many festivals do. And many of the 1920s and 30s films were on DCP. That really shocked me that one of the most prestigious film festivals was showing these wonderful German and Russian silents from the 1920s in DCP. So there is a real hope for that. And getting back to the distribution, we're a different company than Zeitgeist, which is why we're always best friends with them. They are on the cutting edge. They are dealing with a lot of new films. They have some great classics too, but the, most of their filmmakers these days are working in the digital format and will be moving more and more into that. Amy and I run a company that is solely based on restoring classic films. And so that is a much different view of what's happening and what we need to do in the future. It took me 10 years of going to The Real Thing, which is an event in LA and at EMEA every year, before I was convinced that the digital format could look as good as a print, that I could create a DCP that looks as good as a 35 millimeter, with the grain, with the scratches, with dust, if it has to be, to make it look like the original film.
But the digital format, will it be around in 50 years? That's what I'm asking.
That's going to be part of the second part of the discussion.
Oh, okay.
But there
I'm asking if the HD cam film that I made now, how soon will it fade and how obsolete will it be in 10 years? Will I be able to project it?
I have two answers that I was going to get to. One is we're screwed. We're screwed. The digital format, so far there is no standard for archiving digital or for tape. I'll get to that really quickly. The other answer is there's a lot of talented, really smart people coming up in the field that are concerned with this. Some of the best minds are in the digital field, in the video field, in the digital field, in these very arcane formats that don't even exist today, how to preserve them. So I do have hopes that there will be people doing this, but there has to be a lot of education. There's going to be need a lot of work. We are the LP people of the film world. This is true. It really is that, but there are people who are saving LPs, or people who are preserving these. The Association of Moving Image Archivists has a conference. I am also their publicist, by the way, every November. And really, everybody is invited to come, and this is a large part of the discussions is about where we are, how screwed we are, and what are we going to do in the future about this. And there are a lot of talented people dealing with this.
And I think that M.M. Serra is the director of the Filmmakers Co-op who asked that question, and similar to Anthology, I mean, we're also sort of in the LP realm of the film world. And like LPs, film is the most stable medium for moving images, just like LPs might be for audio. And what we're doing as far as transferring, making digital copies of films in our collection for access purposes, whether it be on our forthcoming collections website, or whether it be to give access to something that we never will have the funding to photochemically preserve and screen it in our theaters and make it available to other venues that way. We've had to hire a new person to do just this, one of the people that you're talking about, a digital archivist, to focus on this, to deal with all the issues that come with dealing with digital media. Formats are going to change. Data migration is an issue. Having the technical skills to, purchase and maintain and upkeep the hardware, the servers, and everything like that. So that's become a big part of our archival activities at Anthology.
Oh. Right there.
I have a quick question. Size of screen, somebody mentioned 100-seat theater is about as large as you should go with a Blu-ray, but what's the screen size to that, and are there any larger size screens that you could...
I mean, that's arbitrary. It really depends on what the image that you can get on your screen is going to be.
I think the, not that I want to interrupt this, but I think the second panel, there'll be people who can really answer that question with a lot of expertise more than we can.
Yeah. John Gartenberg here. I think the point that Sarah's bringing up is one that should be emphasized a bit. And it's not that digital cinema isn't here to stay, it is. But anecdotally, for example, my company now goes through warehouses and we find 35 prints. we found a huge collection of 35 British films that were printed in 1986 sitting in a warehouse. I could take those films and put them on a projector and project them in a screening room, and they were like new. If I had a 2-inch tape from 1986 and tried to play it, it would be virtually impossible, because you wouldn't even have the machines around. So the reality is that, and especially when we talk about independent media, is that there is an enormous amount of material from the 1890s to like the 1970s or 80s. It's a huge amount, and a huge amount that's outside the commercial industrial model that exists in 35 millimeter or 16 millimeter, that I seriously doubt all of that material will be converted to digital or even DCP. And therefore, there's an inverse question that has to be asked, which is, what can we do for material that already exists on celluloid to ensure that the equipment that can run it can continue to play, since basically you can take a 16 millimeter print from 1940, assuming it's not too shrunken, it doesn't have vinegar syndrome, and you can project it. And you can take, I mean, David Packard runs the theater in Stamford, where he, in the past at least, could project nitrate 35 millimeter. So I think in the acceptance that digital is here to stay does not mean that all the product that is out there is going to be available in that format, especially for economic reasons. I mean, anecdotally, I can just tell you, in dealing with experimental filmmakers for programming for the Tribeca Film Festival, and also with distributors, some of them like can't even make an HD cam, they can't afford it, they have to send a digital file. So I think in this discussion, we really ought to also be sure that we're not overlooking the reality of film history in this sense.
Okay, to be fair about this, this has been a discussion among all of us when we were planning this conference. The first part of the conference was, DCP is here, what are we going to need to do? I mean, that's a reality. It's just something that we're all gonna have to, pull tight on our belts and dig in and do. The second part, which I'm moderating now. What do you think? Should we go on to this?
We can go a little,
I don't, we can go back and forth. I mean, it's really fluid here.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say something about this part too.
Yeah, but that is part of this conversation too, is because that is a concern of all of ours. So you wanna?
Well, I just wanna, chime in about, as a panelist, but Adam brought up the thing about 35 millimeter projectors, and this has now come up that there are lots of films that may not ever make it to DCP, or may take many, many, many years to make that journey. Maybe by the time they make it, yes, it'll have a new format. It won't even be DCP anymore. But and so the question, I think, on a practical level for people is, do you keep your, if you have 35 millimeter projectors, do you keep them? And the answer, and that's why we're talking about this in the programming part of the panel, as opposed to the technical part, is because the answer is in your programming. If you show films a very wide, varied program of films, if you're doing a lot of archival and older films, repertory films, possibly newer or maybe experimental films that might be on film strictly for artistic reasons, then you should definitely try and keep your 35 millimeter projectors. If all you do is, new first run films, it's nice if you wanted to keep them, but if there's an expense involved, there are people who I've, talked to theater owners who have kept their 35s and now they are just collecting dust, which is kind of, could be seen as romantic, but they're meant to be used. They're not supposed to just sit there and collect dust. So the point is, the answer, you look at your own programming, you'll see, yes, that it'll be worth your while to keep it or not. And one other question I wanted to add also, that I wanted to ask Dennis, because I think it's related to this and it was coming to me. Some of us are fortunate, I know John and me, that we get archival prints from the Library of Congress or the UCLA Film and Television Archives. But it's difficult for them to do that much because the prints are so expensive and they are very, very nervous that they are so easily damaged and will be gone. Do you think that the archives are going to be digitizing any of their stuff and hence making it available to any theater that wants to play it?
Well, the European archives definitely have already begun that. There has been huge funding in the Netherlands and Britain to digitize their collection and to put them up on the web. There's amazing resources for seeing classic films on the web and to provide them to festivals and DCP. I'm not saying this is good, by the way. This is not a judgment. This is just what's happening. MoMA has just done their first digital restoration of a silent film this year. So that's going to happen more. The answer is that part of the problem is manpower, that the archives are all overworked, underpaid, and underfunded. And so they are doing as much as they can to provide films to the public. They are doing an incredible job. Digital might be an answer towards doing this. I'm going to be showing an example only on Blu-ray, sad to say, here. But to digitize a 1914 silent film, 67 minutes, with an orchestral score, because it has to have something on a soundtrack, it's a silent film, I was guessing today was about $50,000. We haven't gotten the bill yet. But you can't, you know, multiply that by how many films in the MoMA collection or in the anthology collection, thousands and thousands and thousands. It's not going to happen. But there are people, archives getting scanners. There are people getting scanners or improving. How long the production of scanners is going to last is another question. We are at a real point in history where we don't know what the next 10, 20, 30 years is. It could be a much nitrate film, by the way, which everybody is terrified of. There is beautiful examples of it lasting in perfect shape for 100 years. Digital, hard drives last 5 years, you have to migrate. LTO tapes, which is probably the most compression-free version of digital storage in this world, every two generations you need a new player, so an LTO 6, which is coming up, will only play LTO 6, LTO 5, and LTO 4. LTO 3s, 2s, and 1s, and I have a lot of those, cannot be played on the new machines. And they are saying every 2 years will be a next generation. So you do the math, you can have about 6 years before you have to migrate your thousands and thousands of LTO tapes to the next generation. And even then, even though it's an open source format, there are proprietary encryptions on these. DCPs are hard drives, moving drives, they can last 5 years. So our DCPs may or may not play in 5 years, and we won't even talk about heat and dust and everything else causing problems for hard drives. Solid state hard drives are a chemical process, so they might last longer, but we don't know how long. And you have a few digits go, and there goes Jimmy Cagney out of the movie. We just don't know what the future brings. There is a lot of things we are looking forward to. I love restoring a film in the digital realm. There are such things you can do and don't have to do. Portrait of Jason, we did as an anti-restoration. We did not do any dust or cleanup because we had the original fine grain and we weren't going to touch it because that's what showed in 1967. So that was easy. The example I have today, we did an enormous amount of dust and scratch until it was almost perfect, and then we realized we lost 5% of the detail. And so we had to scrap all that cleanup. There is so much going on in the digital world that is really cool and available and will help in the future, but we don't know where it's going, and there is a lot of warning signals out there that we are also creating a tsunami of digital media that will disappear in 100 years. Sorry about that.
There's one thing that we can identify where it's going, and it seems to be missing from the discussion so far, in that we all know how fast technology moves. Using an analogy in music, we went from analog LPs to CDs, and we've blown right past CDs to downloads, to direct downloads. The product is sitting on a computer somewhere. And I don't see why we're talking about archiving physical medium in digital when all you have to do is have the product on a computer and have it backed up on more than one computer. It's good forever. Who cares, you know, whether a hard drive degrades? And why would you save hard drives? And that's the way we're going to be receiving our product very quickly. We're going to blow right by hard drives, and we're going to be downloading them directly from the film companies.
The point is that that computer somewhere where it exists has to be maintained, and computers get old and new formats come about, so you have to migrate that data to new formats, to new hardware, and that kind of maintenance.
That's why you back it up, yeah.
Wow. Right, but...
That's a lot of backing up.
Just to give an example, one of my restorations is 8 terabytes. I have two backup hard drives. That's 12 terabyte drives with RAID performance backup. That doesn't mean they'll last. What you are seeing when you are streaming a film on a computer is maybe 250 megabytes of a film. You are seeing a vastly degraded version of what I have restored. So what is being preserved by Google is not the film itself, but a color by numbers version of the film. So not only that, but I bet there are people in this room, not to mention in this world, who can create a worm that can get into Google and destroy a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm not saying that's happening. I'm not saying it could happen. But nothing is permanent. Everything is temporary. And that includes film, sadly. That includes other things. But right now, digital is a concern. I mean, it's not, I might be wrong. I hope I am. But everything is a concern, especially to the archivists who preserve these images.
I don't know. I think I might have lost my thought. Well, I guess but just to what you were saying and what John was saying, there's so much material out there that already exists in not digital format. So bringing that into a digital format is a very daunting and perhaps overwhelming and even unrealistic idea. So there needs to be some way that we'll still be able to access what exists already. Forget about going forward the new stuff, but just the existing body of work that's already there. That may not find a financial reason to become digitalized, but does that mean we'll never be able to see these things again? So I think the need for like a dual standard of still maintaining, which obviously we found out today, you know, the Film Society of Lincoln Center does. I mean, they still have all of their equipment in every format. I think that's really terrific. That's what needs to be done in places that can afford to do that, that has the mandate to do that, that's what they're doing, that's what they're showing, that's their thing. So great, we need more places like that. And MoMA also, you know, the same thing. Because that's gonna be the only way that we're gonna be able to see a lot of this stuff that's going forward.
This is about, you know, archiving it also. For example, we know that when we show a DCP, there's a time limit, at least that's what I thought, when we program films, and we really got into trouble because, you know, the timing in India and here is different, and so we had heck of a time showing that. I understood a little while ago, Leslie said something about an open key. I don't know. So now when you're archiving things and all, is there an open key? I mean, how does this work? I thought each of these DCP things was time bound. According, the key is time bound.
The hard drive and key are actually two separate things. The hard drive is the material that you receive. The key is literally, in a virtual sense, what unlocks all of that material that you have access to. The permission, exactly. So there's just a gatekeeper that gives you the key. And basically, it's up to them to enable any window that they want. You know, the key is an arbitrary determination. So, if you are you a film festival or you're a film festival, my recommendation, as I would recommend to the theaters that I book, I would say the same thing to a film festival, to be very proactive in the process in advance of whatever the film is that you're scheduled to play, when it is scheduled to be. That you are requesting from the source, whoever that person or company is that's providing you with the key, that you communicate with them early on that you need the key at a certain time, that you need a particular window of time prior to the actual show so that you can do a dry run of your film, make sure everything is working, make sure there are no, you know, problems, that you have time to make the necessary adjustments if there are issues, and that also that you make sure that the key end time is not running right up against whenever it is that your film is supposed to end. I've run into some similar instances where it's just, you know, Eastern time versus Pacific time, and it's just a 3-hour window, but it was literally that 3 hours difference that put a theater out of a show. So I think, you know, it's just very open communication and a proactive approach to dealing with the people who are controlling the keys that you have access to just pushing for what you need. And if they tell you, we can't do this, you just have to keep pushing them and try to get what you need. And that's really the best advice I can give, is to just be an advocate for yourself.
So when that, now that is for us as a film festival.
Sure.
So when that film is being kept somewhere, who, just the filmmaker has that key and can keep sort of in?
No, usually it's a third party that controls the key process. I mean, it may be a little bit different on the festival circuit if a film is not already in circulation with a distribution company that owns the rights to it. Then it's presumably either the filmmaker or the production company that is controlling the process by which you, the film festival, are receiving the movie. So it would either be, depending on who you're dealing with and where through the process of distribution the film has gone, that either perhaps the producer or filmmaker has the access and ability, technologically speaking, to email you and issue you that key. So it's really just knowing who your point person is with every respective film and communicating with that individual or with that company. When we're talking about movies that are in distribution circulation and keys, usually it's, you know, through Technicolor or Deluxe, that you're predominantly Technicolor, that, you know, they control the key process. I don't think Zeitgeist even does keys, do they, Emily? Which is a wonderful thing.
Dennis,
if you
just
don't.
Asked me that. Yeah, we don't use keys.
I don't think you do. You know, there are some distributors.
I don't think we use keys.
Right. You know, for those companies who aren't crazy and paranoid over nothing, you know, they don't issue keys. I mean, it's
a protection security thing that, but it's true. We're dealing with theaters that we trust already anyway with our material.
Right.
So we're not, you know, concerned that they're screening the film 7 times a day instead of the 3 times, you know,
right.
And only reporting 3 shows and they're actually screening at 7 or what are the, there are all these kind of paranoid
right.
type and reasons why people want to control, and they see this as an advantage because when you have a 35 millimeter print and you ship it out, you don't know where that 35 millimeter could go anywhere, right? And they could do anything with it. But this gives the owner of the material that control.
Yes.
However, it's a huge pain because you have all these problems, and I think if you're not trusting the people you're doing business with, you shouldn't be playing your films with
That's
them
a great
to
point.
Begin with. So
yeah,
it kind of is, it's the one thing of this process that has changed a bit, the relationship between, not with you, but with other distributors and exhibitors, because they do now have more control over what you're doing with that. And it seems unnecessary to me too, but I don't know, that's the way they feel. Now, if people, we have.
Yeah, I'm just saying we're living in a different world. That I have no encryption on our DCPs and I have no keys because I don't want to be getting a phone call at 11:30 at night saying my DCP's not working. I work out of my house, I'd wake up, it'd wake up the dogs. I don't want this. But
that's good to know.
But when you're working at Warner Brothers and there are people who actually want to steal your movie, sadly, mine are not as in great demand for theft, Batman, or thank God I'm not doing Lone Ranger, but there are people willing to steal that material and convert it to Blu-rays to sell on 42nd Street. So they have different concerns. I think they are unfounded in many ways as well. But that does also bring up what's going to happen to these DCPs in the future with the encryption and with the keys, and those are two different things. And are we going to be able to play them in 10 years? And the answer is no. So my DCPs probably not either, but there are concerns about this.
And they're already segueing. I mean, some of the studios and some of the theaters that I represent have already bypassed the hard drive process and are just getting the film sent to them by satellite. So it's, you know, it's that immediate, the change that's happening technologically speaking, that the satellite process is now part of it.
And the people on the second panel will be able to talk, I'm sure, anything, any questions about KDMs and that kind of stuff. And Catherine?
Hi, everybody. My name is Catherine, and I'm running a small art house cinema, one screen, in Long Island, Patchogue. And we are in the beginning process of raising funds for our very first DCP. And I'm very curious to find out how many here are in the same place, and we can share a little bit about the process of raising funds for DCP. We started just as a reference. We started basically having a small fundraiser with Isabella Rossellini, who is sort of our wonderful person who helps us out. We raised a little bit of money there, and then we have moved on to sending out flyers and asking for funding, and sort of educating our audience of the need to do this. And the process is slow. We're halfway there. We have figured out that we need about $55,000 to do the whole transition. And I was, again, wondering if any of you had any other ideas, or if you had run into any problems, or had success stories.
Are
you
doing a Kickstarter campaign already?
We haven't started with the Kickstarter, no.
I could tell you that a number of movie theaters across the country have very successfully and swiftly put out a Kickstarter campaign. I represent a couple of theaters that did either a Kickstarter campaign or a Kickstarter campaign in concert with a targeted mailing to higher level members and then trickling down to all members. And there was a great deal of trepidation for one exhibitor in particular who's in a relatively small market, I would say. And she's a for-profit, she's not a non-for-profit, so she didn't have that angle to go out with. And you know, it's all or nothing if you go the Kickstarter route. If you don't raise the amount stated in your goal, you get zero. And you know, we talked about it extensively. She deliberated and she went for it and she got it and even had in excess of what she needed to get. And that seems to be a success story that's being echoed around the country in, you know, really small market situations sometimes where you wouldn't expect the community in town to necessarily produce and support what's needed of that campaign, and yet we're seeing it actually work. So I would say, especially if you've already reached you know, a percentage of your goal, to not be daunted by trying something like that.
Great, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more question.
I actually just wanted to, well, first of all, you can also use Indiegogo, so you don't have to do
what
it.
What is it called?
You can use Indiegogo, so you don't have to do it as an all or nothing proposition. And Austin Film Society just raised $120,000 that way, so I don't know if they used Indiegogo or Kickstarter. I just had to say that I would feel really remiss to not bring up something because there's all these people in the room that love film. Many of you know, many of you maybe don't know that Duart is closing their vaults. I've been over there. There are thousands of films that are going to be orphaned. There are negatives, there's A and B rolls, there's just an amazing amount of stuff. If you know filmmakers, I'm sure all of you do, please let them know that they need to get in touch with Duart, and they need to get their material out of there because the vaults are really shutting down. I found Women Make Movies films that I had no idea were there, that filmmakers had placed there. If you want more information, just email me, dz@wmm.com. Is Josh here from MoMA? Sandra Schulberg and Josh from MoMA have been working with Steve Blakely at Duart to try to identify the material that's there. Sarah's been over there, so anyway. And I just had another question that maybe is the next part of this, but being totally ignorant of this, unfortunately. For you, Emily, I think that you'd know, or Dennis, how much does it cost to go back to a 35mm and make a DCP? Or do you go back to the 35mm? What do you go back to?
You have to make it from digital material, so you have to...
If you have a 2K... I'm sorry. If you have a 2K transfer, that's easy. That's $3,000, $5,000. If you start from film, as we did with what we're going to be showing next, Lauren, if you want to alert the projectionist about that, by the way, it can be $50,000 to $100,000 for a feature film. Wow. If you do it right, if you do digital cleanup, if you go to 2K or 4K, that's another big decision. There's
that's
a
insane.
Lot. It is insane, yes. And and trust me, we know. We are insane. But we do it. We are doing it with I Am Cuba, which is 141 minutes long. There is, and we're going to do 4K. So if there is, as I was telling Emily before, if there are films in every collection that make money and is worth doing, it's going to be a problem for the others. And that's why there's archives and why distributors should consider working with the archives in the future, because that's going to save the films, not praying that film's going to stay. Oh.
Let's see. Okay. Okay. Well, if it's Karen. Right.
Yeah, I actually have a question. As we're talking about this wealth of history and material that will remain available in a variety of formats, what would you say to, or what would be your advice in regard, you know, to programming, to small cinemas, you know, screens, houses that might have one or two screens that may be considering DCP or the conversion and may have to convert for economic reasons in their community, but at the same time, of course, many of us would like to see them still show a variety of formats. How does one advise a house that needs to address these issues on an equipment basis?
You know, as I'd been mentioning earlier, save all of your equipment that you already have if you can. I know, Dylan, you mentioned some theaters are just literally collecting dust with what they have. But, you know, if you have the luxury of keeping your 35 millimeter projector, I would recommend that if you can just go out and literally buy a couple of old 35 millimeter prints, whatever the movies are. I'm not saying films that you have to run, simply to have on hand to every so often, quarterly or whatever it is, to turn the projector on and run it, just like you don't want your car battery to die. So you know, turn that car over if you've got something sitting in a garage or something. You know, just use the equipment every now and again to preserve it and have it serviced as you normally would. You could even just hang on to some old trailers that you've been, you know, keeping in the booth for whatever apparent reason and just run a trailer reel. But it's really, to me, is if you have the luxury, remain a hybrid model in terms of what you keep in your booth. Keep everything for now. Okay. Maybe VHS is making a comeback too. Who knows? No,
I also want to add one thing to that and what I said before. If you have 35 millimeter, ideally the thing is to have two 35s. There's really nothing that's going to be more obsolete than a single 35 millimeter projector with a platter attached to it. Okay. Because any prints you get, whether it's from Anthology Film Archives or Milestone or Library of Congress, anybody, they're not going to loan it to you to put on a platter. There's no way it's going to happen. But, you know, so really what you need to do, if you can keep two projectors, that's what you're looking for. We just, you know, we in two of our three theaters, we have 35, and the only piece of equipment that went to the scrap was the platters, because nobody wants them, so.
Yeah, ironically, it's a reversion back to reel all of a sudden. That's actually more advantageous if you are going to keep 35. I would definitely agree.
Yeah. All right. So we're running late, but we're gonna have one more. Our second panel has been sitting very patiently, but we can't turn Amy Heller from Milestone Film and Video.
Thanks. I just wanted to say something that isn't exactly on point, but I think it's something that, because we all care about our culture. And we have a feeling about history, and we have a feeling about our own communities, that the problem that I was thinking about what you were saying, Emily, is that because so many titles are, for at least for some time, maybe forever, we don't know, are going to be lost, that we may lose the ability to show films that have particular resonance in our community, in our town, in the population that lives near us. The things that that local theaters can do, and that's a real issue, and that's something that I think we need to keep in mind. I mean, we've been in business for 23 years. Maybe a third of our films are digital, maybe less. That we can't even make DCPs on most of the films we've restored over all this time. And we'll work on it. You know, we were, as Dennis was saying, we'll try to do I Am Cuba, and we have some other titles, but it still means that hundreds of films in our own collection are going to take a long time to become available to show again. And so, to me, the thing that as a kind of as a, you know, as film people, as cinema people, and as people who care about our culture, that the what that means in terms of how we see our history, how we see our film history, I think that's something that we're going to be grappling with for a long time.
All right. Well, on that note, I think, like I said, our second panel's been sitting very, very patiently. I think we're going to watch a clip from Dennis's restoration.
Yeah, and take a short break and then get back to the second panel. I'll do a quick introduction. I don't believe any discussion on media should not have moving images. I just feel against it. And so we tried to get some from others, but I finally said we got a brand new restoration. It was finished actually yesterday. And this is a film that really can't be shown on film. This is a 1914 film. What exists now is 35 millimeter nitrate and 16 millimeter positive from 1947. UCLA did blow it up to 35 millimeter restoration, but after five screenings, the print was damaged and is no longer being shown. The other reason why it's best in digital, it is a film that shows at 16 frames per second, and the original orchestral score exists from 1914. So because of digital, we can bring out a film that has the full orchestral score as it was shown in 1914. There's still damage, there's still other stuff, but it can be shown this way. There are some advantages to the digital age, and I wanted to point it out at this conference. And it's just to set this up, Edward S. Curtis, the famous Indian photographer, was desperate for money in 1914. He came up with the brilliant idea of making a feature film that was going to gross profit $100,000. As Emily and I know, that usually doesn't happen. And in fact, it didn't. So there were only about two or three prints of this film in existence in 1914. And the fact that it still exists in some forms today was pretty much a miracle. It's of the Kwakakawaki Indians, formerly the Kwakiutl of the Pacific Northwest. We have some great advisors who helped us on this, Aaron Glass and Brett Evans. And sadly, this is not DCP because the room's not set up for it. And sadly, the Blu-ray isn't on it, but I think you'll find it a really cool experience. And I guess we should turn off the microphones now and present the film. Thanks.